Dear listener, if you like this podcast, I want to tell you about something else you might enjoy as well. Every week, I host an online meetup. In each meeting, I give a presentation on some programming topic, or I bring a guest to the group for a discussion, or I do a code review on a member's code base, or I do some kind of consultation with one of our members. Coming to this meetup is kind of like listening to this podcast, except it's live and interactive, which means you get a chance to ask questions and participate in a conversation with other programmers like yourself. The meetup is also a fun place to meet some new friends. To learn more and to sign up, visit codewithjason.com/meetup. Now on to the episode. Hey, today I'm here with Tom Henrik Odland. Tom, welcome.
Thank you.
So I had a little bit of trouble with your last name. Tom is obviously a name I'm familiar with. And your middle name, Henrik, or maybe it's the first part of your last name, I don't know. Either way, that was a pretty phonetic word for me. But then your last name was hard for me. You're Norwegian, and I assume that's a Norwegian last name, right?
It is. It is a Norwegian last name. It's actually a place in Norway, a little bit outside of Bergen. And a lot of Norwegian last names are either based on a place or is taken from the old, I guess, Danish way, where you use like the Henderson, or like you have the sum of.
Oh, I see.
Last names. But my name is a place name.
Okay. And is Henrik your middle name or is it part of your last name?
That's my middle name, yeah.
Got it. Okay. And where in Norway are you?
I am located in a very small town called Florø, which is a bit north of Bergen. I guess most viewers can locate Bergen pretty easily on the map, and then just half an hour airline north, you have Florø. So it's a very, it's a small town, about population of 10,000.
Okay. You know, St. Bergen, that reminds me of Candace Bergen, you know, that actress from the show Murphy Brown. Maybe that's more of a U.S. thing, but that makes me wonder Norwegian descent. Anyway, maybe. You and I first met recently, because you're involved with a writing project with Obi Fernandez, is that right?
That's right.
Yeah, tell me a bit about that.
Yeah, so the book we're talking about here is the Railsway, the Railsway 7, to be specific. But we started actually with Railsway 6 to upgrade the Railsway 5. And the story goes, if we have time for that, mm-hmm. Back in 2009, I lived in Buenos Aires in Argentina. And at that time, I've been a Rails developer for a couple of years already. So pretty early adapter of Rails. And the Rails community in Argentina was sort of like just started, or the Ruby community was just starting off. And I had this idea, why not organize a conference? Have not done that before, so why not? So I got some more people onto the idea, and we created an organization around organizing a Rails conference. And one of the keynote speakers was Obi Fernandez on that conference. The conference was called Locos por Rails, or Locos por Rails, as they say in Spanish, which means crazy about Rails. And Obi was I reached out to Obi because, of course, I was a big fan. I had the Railsway, the first Railsway book, obviously, And I reached out to Obi, like, okay, this is probably a long shot, but it didn't take that long for him to respond, actually. And he was like, yeah, this is up. I'm in. I really love to go to Argentina. And he was like really, really positive. So that was a really good, good feedback. And then it was easier to get more speakers lined up for the conference. Anyway.
Yeah. Sorry. I want to dwell on that for a second because, you know, I organize a conference myself, Sin City Ruby. And incidentally, yeah. Obi spoke at Sin City Ruby just last month. And sometimes people ask me, like, with the podcast, they're like, how did you get these guests that you got? Because I've had some kind of like big names or whatever on the podcast. I'm like, well, right. I just asked. And it's kind of like a good life lesson. Like, if you want something, sometimes you can just ask and you'll get it.
Yeah. Or yeah, at least you get it. You will get an answer. Most people will definitely provide you with an answer. We reached out to DHH as well for that very same conference, and I think he actually wanted to come, but he couldn't. But we had him on video, actually. So if I remember, he didn't do like a presentation or anything like that, but we had like a Q&A session in video with him in that conference. So yeah, I agree. Reach out and you'll be surprised. Yeah. At least that was a positive surprise. So that was really like a good start to for everybody involved to like really, really pull this off. I think it was a great success. It's definitely there are some videos online, old videos on YouTube. I think, oh yeah, another famous Rails person was Akita on Rails. I don't know if you remember. Akita is a Brazilian guy. He does a lot of. He's more like a generalist technologist at this time, I think. But he was very trying to get the Rails community going in Brazil, and he was part of organizing the Rails conference in Brazil. And I don't know if it was the year after or around the same. It was in those years, 2009, 2010, 11, around that time. Anyway, fast forward many years, I moved back to Norway. I just had my firstborn. And as anyone with kids know, the firstborn is, you know, everything is new. You're inexperienced in all of this. There's a lot to learn. It doesn't come with, there are lots of manuals, but even though you have a stack of books, there is so many things that you just have to experience it. Anyway, one evening he was finally asleep. I was sitting down, enjoying a glass of wine, listening to some music, and then an email from Obi pops up asking, is anyone interested in taking over the gist of the email? Is anyone interested in taking over the Railsway project? Because he didn't have time to continue to update it. And I was like, yeah, sure, why not? I've never done that before. And we were just in the process of the product that I was working on. We had to upgrade to Rails 6 anyways. So I figured, okay, well, why not join a book project and learn about Rails 6 that way? So sort of like hit, what do you call it, two birds in one rock? Something like that?
Yeah, killing two birds with one stone.
Yeah. So I answered the email, and then a couple of weeks later, didn't think about it anymore. I thought like, okay, well, maybe it was a long shot. But anyway, you know, the long shots, they tend to hit as well. So then all of a sudden, out of the blue, I received an email. Welcome aboard, you and another guy, Lucas, in Germany. I don't know if we were the only ones interested, but we were also picked for the project. So we had a handover. And at the in the same time, I think the contract that Obi had with the publisher went out, or at least that same year. So that meant that we could actually put it back into Leanpub. And that was actually really great, because then we could work on it and have releases, continuously releases whenever we had an update, and didn't have to like, it made the whole work process a lot more or less pressured, if you know what I mean. And we were the two of us working on it. So, so that was nice. That was a nice start of my book writing career. I'm not going to announce what the next will be, but the Railsway 8 is in the, what do you call it?
It's in the works. It's process. In the pipeline. In process. Okay.
Yeah. In process. Yeah. And that's going to be, we're going to do something a little bit differently with the Railsway. So for anyone following, I'm not going to push any dates or anything for when this will start hitting the shelf on Leanpub, but hopefully around summertime, before in good time before Rails 8 is released, though.
Okay. Different question. I'm very curious, and maybe you told me a previous time we talked, but what took you to Argentina when you moved there?
Yeah, that's a good question. then I have to go back to, because I played football or soccer, for the American term, when I was growing up and as a boy. And my favorite team in the World Cup was Argentina. At that time, back in '86, Maradona was the big hero. Anyways, fast forward many years, I was finishing up my thesis, at that time I was also I did that actually at the Technical University in Lisbon in Portugal, and I met a few other Norwegians doing the same exchange thing to like, okay, you can go to a different European university and finish off your thesis, which was a really nice thing to do. But I had in my plans to go for an MBA. I always wanted to have that business part of things as well. And my background is in computer or software engineering, it was called, or software development. But I also wanted that business part of it, entrepreneurship kind of studies. So I was looking for an MBA program, and I was thinking that maybe to do it in Spain, because then I could learn Spanish at the same time. At that time, Portuguese was for some reason really hard to learn. So I figured Spanish might be easier. So why not go to Spain and again do two things?
Yeah, two birds, one stone. Yeah,
learn Spanish and get an MBA.
So did your desire to learn Spanish precede going to Spain? You said.
Yeah, that was my idea. Yeah, to learn. I wanted to learn a third world language besides of English, basically.
Okay.
It was, I don't know, bucket list goal, whatever. It was there, you know, one of those things that I wanted to do. And and a friend of one of the guys that I was living with in Lisbon, he was also in the same thought process, but he was like, but hey, why not go to Argentina? And I was like, Yeah, why not? Argentina, they speak Spanish. I'm a fan of the football team.
I'm noticing like a why not theme in your decision-making process.
Okay.
Yeah, which I really respect. I like that. Yeah, it's like,
Okay.
do this big crazy thing. Why not?
Yeah, exactly. Why not? Why not? That was my thinking. Why not? I get to do what I set out to do, and but in a different context, obviously. That was also a little bit like how luck kind of plays into life as well in these strange moments. I think that the luck part here, going to Argentina, was that, of course, to learn Spanish was the primary objective, secondary objective, to get an MBA. But in order to do an MBA, I had to learn Spanish first, right? So I set out to, like, how can we do that? So I emailed a bunch of universities, asked if they had a Spanish learning program. And fortunately, it was one university that replied and said, we don't have a program in place, but we're more than happy to tailor one for you. So, okay, well, that's interesting. We're two Norwegians eager to learn Spanish. We need to learn it within 3 months. So we said 3 months full time learning Spanish. And they set up a complete program, basically, doing it in 3 months. The one thing that I didn't pay attention to, I don't always pay too much attention to all, like, the details, but as long as, like, I get the overall, it's good. But I didn't know that, for example, Buenos Aires. I thought Buenos Aires, the city, was the only thing, but you also have the province called Buenos Aires. And what I didn't read or didn't catch was that the university was not the University of Buenos Aires. It was the University of the province of Buenos Aires, which is in another city way outside of Buenos Aires. So we ended up basically 4 hours drive from Buenos Aires in Argentine standard small city. The good thing with that was that they had no experience with tourism. There was no expats, no foreigners. They all went to Buenos Aires, the city. And so there we were basically forced from day one to you go out somewhere, bring the dictionary. It was like, okay, we're learning Spanish.
That's great. I visited Puerto Rico about a year ago, and it was the first Spanish-speaking place I had visited. But every time I tried to speak Spanish to somebody, they would just speak English back to me, and it was really frustrating because I was all excited to finally visit somewhere where they speak Spanish, but everybody just spoke English. So that's really great that you're able to get that experience where it was sink or swim, you just had to do it.
There was like, okay, we don't speak, like, of course you have the body language, and you can point and you can get as far as you can, but it's you need to at some point you need to speak, right? And they speak back to you and, like, okay, sorry, hold on a second, what was that word again? So that was but it was really good. I can if for anyone learning a new language and you want to learn it fast, then go to a place where they do not speak any of the languages that you already speak, and then you're forced. I mean, that is definitely a painful but fast. But I think when you're learning something, you have to go through some sort of pain anyways. I don't think there is any, and that goes back to, like, learning programming as well. I found that quite painful in the beginning, right? I mean, it's and I don't think anyone that I've talked to, and I've talked to, like, really, really good programmers, and they all say the same thing. Well, started out, it was painful, yeah, but you had this drive that, well, I really want to learn it. I don't know why, but I have to learn this. I want to learn this. So then you manage somehow to go through with it.
I'm curious if you had to do it again, if you're going to learn another new language, would you enroll in some kind of formal class or would you do it a different way?
No, I think the good thing was to have that formal class because it sort of gives you structure also, right? We had the way that they split it up was that we had one teacher that was focusing on vocabulary, basically showing us like the objects and telling us the name and we repeat like the real basic stuff. And then we had one teacher that was focusing purely on grammar. And that's the point where I disagreed a little bit because I did not think that, or in my mind, to learn grammar at the same time as you're learning vocabulary didn't make sense in one way to me. Because if you think of kids, for example, when they learn the language, they don't think about the grammar, they just learn the language, right? But anyway, it helped you to get some structure anyways. And that when you talk to people and you can somehow speak grammatically somewhat correct, it's easier, and then they will make more of an effort, and it really helped. So I would recommend to have that structure. But today, like this was back in 2003, 2004, and there was no iPhone with Duolingo and all of those things. Today, it's a lot easier to start building vocabulary before even going to a country. So I think you could learn a new language even faster.
Yeah. I went to France last year and I heard that French people don't really like to speak English. Even if they can, they don't like to, was what I heard. And yeah. So I'm like, okay, well, before we go, I better learn some French. And so by this time I kind of already had an idea for, how to learn languages, because I had been, let's see, at that time, I had spent about 2 years studying Chinese. I had a Chinese friend who would speak Chinese with me once a week. We would do like 30 minutes of Chinese and 30 minutes of English. And I really liked that format. And so I did the same thing with French, and I found a couple friends to help me. And I spent like, it was like about two sessions a week usually. So an average of like an hour a week of speaking French. And you know, French spelling, like I don't find French very phonetic. Like you look at a French word and there's so many silent letters, like it's so counterintuitive to pronounce it. So I didn't focus on reading and writing much in the beginning. I just focused on speaking, which was a piece of advice I got from somewhere. To start with the spoken language and then not do reading or writing until later. Like I can converse in Chinese, but I can't read any Chinese characters. Like I can recognize like five Chinese characters and that's like all.
Well, but that's still pretty good though.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's like 50,000 Chinese characters depending how you count. So I got... anyway, I'm like 1/10,000th of the way there. Yeah, but having somebody to speak with was really helpful. Just like that conversation. You know, people say like doing immersion is the way to go, but like being in a country, like the kinds of interactions you have are not always that conducive to learning. Because like, think about a restaurant. Like when I went to France, when you go to a restaurant, they ask you, eat or drink. Like the first thing they say when you go in is eat or drink. I was not prepared for that or expecting that because in America they say, how many? And right. So they asked me in French and I'm like, I don't even know what that means or why you're like, I didn't get it. And, you know, people are like trying to do their jobs and stuff And it's like, they don't want to slow down and like hold your hand and have a conversation and stuff like that. It's like these transactional interactions. Mm-hmm. So I like it better when I have like time to have like a relaxed conversation with somebody. Did you have that opportunity in Argentina, like people outside of class, to just like have an unhurried conversation with you?
Yeah, that was actually one of the, I guess one of the benefits of being a few foreigner in a place where they're not used to having a lot of expats or tourists coming at that time, because people and it was a small, you know, in one way it's a smaller town, smaller city kind of scale, and people wanted to just sit and have coffee and have converse. Like, we were even interviewed by the local newspaper, and it was like the guys at the university took us out to parties with their friends, and it was a really, really inclusive, it's a really inclusive society. So that was I think, yeah, it wasn't one day there was like something going on where we got invited to something. So, and that really helps, because yeah, you practice language in so many different contexts, right? And constantly hearing it as well really helps.
Okay. Okay, different question about Argentina. Like, when you first started living there, was there anything that, I'm sure there was there anything that surprised you about Argentina that you didn't expect?
That surprised me. I guess I was a bit surprised by how similar the nature in Argentina is to the nature in Norway.
Interesting.
So, like, two countries on the opposite side, almost on the opposite sides of the world. Like, Argentina has the South Pole, we have the North Pole, sort of. And the nature was quite similar. That was one of the things that got me. And that also, in the same, they don't have, you know, poison. Well, they probably do. Someone's going to arrest me if I say that, but I don't think that they have a lot of like poisonous insects, and we don't have that either. You have the regular, the mosquitoes, the, you know, the small ones that doesn't do too much harm. I think that was the surprise. And then I really liked the culture, the inclusiveness, and how open, at least seemingly, people were. That was very nice. I really loved my stay in Argentina. I lived there for 10 years, ended up marrying my wife, who's half Argentine, but still. I think that must be it.
Okay. Very interesting. And then you lived in Argentina for like 10 years, and then you moved back to Norway, and you're telling me a bit about your job. Where do you work now?
I work for a company called EG. It's a Danish company, actually. And the reason for that was the company that I were the co-founded. And we built a product around, quality control for mainly the fish farmers in Norway. We were acquired by a company.
Wait, sorry, I have to stop you there. So you built a business that was around quality control for fish farmers. How did you get into that?
Okay. That's, well, first I moved back to Norway. I started or co-founded a company with, at that time, three other partners, but we were only two living in No, the three of us were living in Norway, and one was actually in California. Long story short, after a couple of years, we were down to the last two of us. But the beginning of that company journey was we didn't actually have an idea for a product. We were kind of exploring, and we did a lot of consultant type work. And one of the jobs we did was to build basically a mobile app for an existing system that was a quality control system for fish farmers. But at that time, they wanted to do more with their with the quality control system that they had and or that they were using at the time. But it was no, it was a little bit off the shelf, and it wasn't really like professionally done, and there was no company behind it. I think it was a one person company that has put together something and wasn't following up. So they were looking for someone or some that could actually build a proper system. So then we got a contract. We built the system for the fish, like a group of fish farmers. It's called a Salmon Group, actually. It's a fish farming kind of union or something, if that makes sense. So we built the system for them and their members,
Okay, and
obviously.
sorry, is fish farming big in Norway?
It's pretty big, yeah,
Okay.
pretty big. It's definitely what we are betting on besides the oil at the moment. Export of food is the Norwegian salmon is good.
Got it. Okay.
Farmed in Norway, and the reason I'm saying that is that it's extremely regulated, and that's why they needed to have a quality system in place because they have so many regulations that they need to follow up on, and part of that has to be done digitally. So they were actually forced to go from pen and paper, Excel, to have a full system where they can send in proper reports on a lot of different things, basically. So we created that system. Then we managed to get ownership of it, and that's when me and my co-founder at that time created, based on that system, we created a new system called InControl, and we tried to grow that as much as we could, and then of course we a company came in, were interested, and at that time it was kind of like perfect timing. And I think we went a little bit like, why not? See where this is taking us. Can we get a good deal? And we also had an investor with us that really helped us to navigate. And he was a little bit like, yeah, have a conversation with these guys, see what they want, see what kind of deal we can get. I mean, you can always walk away. I mean, as long as nothing is signed, there's always you still have the room to walk away.
And
But
how long was it between when you started that venture and when this company started expressing interest?
this it went really fast, actually, like almost six or between 6 to 9 months after we launched,
Oh, wow. Okay.
actually. Yeah, so it was really fast, and that's why we were sort of like, maybe this is too early, should we could we Could we make this bigger and make more money? But we, long story, we got a good deal, and we said, okay, better to be part of a bigger. It was still early because they hadn't acquired that many company, and they had the growth projections for the future, and as long as we could be part of that, it would. We saw that, okay, this can be fun. 2 months later, COVID hits, right? So that was sort of like a little bit of a lucky strike because everything got shut down. And at that time, it was definitely good to be part of a bigger organization, right? A lot of things that I don't think we would have. Well, if we would have, it would have been very hard if we would have survived that at all. Me and my co-founder had many conversations on this topic. Anyway, we felt that, okay, this was definitely a lucky strike. COVID hit. And through the COVID period, the company managed to grow more. We got actually listed on the stock market in Norway. And then the summer after, EG came in, and well, I think there's been probably a lot of others, but EG came in and started to buy up the entire company, and then we got delisted. So now I'm part of EG, which is a large software as a service company with lots of verticals in different industries. So the unit that I'm in at the moment is focusing mostly on facility management and energy management.
I see. Okay. So you're no longer working on the fish stuff. You're working on different products now.
Yeah, so that's one thing that, you know, it's a product that I was part of creating, but on the way, at least the last years, I kind of like got further and further away from that product and in order to grow in the company. And that's a new exciting journey ahead, right?
Okay.
So that's how that came about.
And since I'm, you know, I kind of have a reputation as the Rails testing guy, I think you mentioned to me that you're planning to, or you have aspirations to have your team do more testing or something like that. Do I have that right?
Yeah. Absolutely. We have a lot of the products are quite to put it in a nice way, ready for some modernization, and of course to modernize the large, pretty large systems. It's not something you just want to do blindfolded, right? You want to have test coverage in place, but not just that. It's also the fact that to run or to do test-driven development, it forces you to think more about what it is that you are about to implement. It forces you to think about the design more in depth, more than doing just exploratory kind of program and figure out programming and then figure out, okay, does this like, but it's a testing, but it's in a different way. You still test your coding, but you're doing it manually, like, does this work? And then finally when it works, you're happy with your code, but once you do the test driven, you have the tests in place, and it's a lot easier to continuously improve on your code until you get to a stage where you're happy with it. And that is the reason. It's also we started an initiative of consolidating, like we wanted to see how can we consolidate a lot of the products within our segment or our vertical, because they're doing a lot of the same things, right? We're processing a lot of the same data, where it's a lot of like same input and same kind of like the same output. Can we create common services, shared services type things here? So that's when we started looking into the famous microservices architecture. And we hired Fred George, which is a well-known microservices, I would say, probably one of the ones that started with microservices. He has some really great talks about it on YouTube. So we got him on board to teach us like how do we do microservices? And that's, I need to put a little bit of background on how we came across that. Is we have the, I think the, one of the largest public organizations in Norway, the what's in English, the labor agency, Norwegian labor agency, something like that. The one, the organization that takes care of sick benefits and unemployment benefits and all of that. We have a very good healthcare system or benefit system in Norway. So if you are sick, you still will get paid, basically, right? If you are unemployed, you will still have, you will still get paid, not the full amount that you were used to, but you will still get paid. And that the agency is taking care of all of those payments. So they had two guys there that were on a podcast that I listened to, probably similar to this, where they were explaining a little bit how they, because I was always interested in how they did it, because they have a lot of, or had a lot of legacy systems, and they modernized quite well. And it went, I would say, from a tech perspective, it's really well done. It's one of those organizations that you look up to. And so I was thinking, like, how do these guys do it? Because they're like, I think we have something similar. So I listened to the podcast and they mentioned Fred George. And then I looked up Fred George and I said, I reached out if he's helped them, could he help us with something similar, at least come and have a look. And he did. And we had a boot camp, with him where, and in the boot camp, it's very, you go back to the basics of, the concept of object-oriented programming. Basically going, you dive into the concept, the important concepts of having, like, creating your objects in a way that they, with less side effects, that's it, without, like, it's sort of like the mix of object orientation and functional programming. Like, I, you see, have the simplicity but not the side effects. And in order to, like, one of the main concepts there is, of course, encapsulation, right? So we were all, like, blown away by Fred and then how he made the concept of the object so simple, small functions, small objects, everything small. But he was a very, what can I say, enforcing that task-driven development. Like, there was no way that he would allow anyone to start implementing anything before there was a test in place for it. And that's how we sort of, like, saw the light and, like, oh my God, this is actually, it makes things easier, because it can seem counterproductive, but then at the end of the day, it was like, holy cow, this was fun. You know, now I felt that I did a good job. It's tested. It's good, high quality, and everybody, it's a good design for it. And it can easily be refactored, and I will know that it will run, like, even though upgrading a library or whatever, just run the test suite, and the test suite will tell you if there's anything you need to fix in there. So that's why we are striving for going for the test-driven development mantra.
Okay. And just for my understanding, what was the timeline of this? When was the intervention from Fred George?
This was before we were acquired by EG. So this was back in, I think it's close to 2 years ago now, actually. Yeah.
Okay. And just for my own interest in, like, since I do consulting myself, and not just, like, contracting coding by the hour kind of thing, but, like, kind of more similar stuff to what Fred George seems to do, although I haven't heard of him before now. you told me about how you heard about Fred George, and then what were you hiring Fred George for exactly? Because you mentioned the microservices stuff and then object-oriented programming and testing. Was there one of those specifically that you were seeking from Fred George in the beginning, or how did you think about that?
No, it was more like, the thinking was more like, okay, we are going to create a transition or migrate products over to a new architecture. But this is new, it's a new paradigm for everyone involved. They haven't worked in this environment. We dabbled a little bit with different things and creating different services, but it didn't feel right. There was something like, this should be, from all the studying and the reading, it's like it should be simpler somehow. Then we ended up with more complexity than what we intend. Like, we intended to take something complex and make it simpler was the idea. So I figured, okay, we need to there are some fundamentals here that we need to learn, and that's why I went sort of looking for who can teach us this.
I see.
And that's when I reached out to Fred, and he came in and he explained what he can do, what he did with Nav, what he can do for us, and we went like, okay, that sounds perfect.
Okay.
So I think, and it's also another aspect of all of this is that it's sort of like onboarding new developers, right? You have I would say a safe environment to start working in. If you are coming in as a new developer and you start working in and I've done this myself as well, right? In a monolithic kind of huge monolithic world, it can feel like, do I dare to? I have an idea for how to fix this, but I'm not sure. Maybe I'll break something. I don't know. If there is not a lot of test coverage, you definitely feel unsecure as well, right? So it doesn't help on building up your confidence as a developer. But I feel that when you're working with these microservices or small objects, if it's in a just pure object-oriented application, you feel you have that safety, so you're not afraid to try out any crazy idea, and you know immediately if it works or doesn't work. And that's what I really like, is to have that quick feedback on anything it is that you do. Is that okay? This worked. It didn't work.
Okay.
That's also I think it's a important takeaway to have. I think it's the term is socio-technical environment,
okay,
or safe environment, something like that. I'm not sure. I'm not all familiar with all the terms around, but at least the main point is that I want the developers to have a good feeling when they come to work and are finished with work. It shouldn't be like, you know, crazy at work. Sometimes it is, but it shouldn't be.
Yeah.
But have that environment. Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like that too. Like having, you know, creating an environment where the developers can feel good about their day-to-day existence isn't just something to do out of the goodness of your heart. It has an actual material impact on productivity and stuff like that.
Right.
Yeah, and what was the level of experience on the team with things like testing and object-oriented programming, you know, 2 years ago or whatever before Fred George came in and provided some training and stuff like that?
I think most of, and I also participated myself in this bootcamp. Most of us had some background in testing, at least I had in Rails, and now I found myself, I had to learn C# for this actually as well, so it was even more interesting. I had no I have this habit of putting myself in situations where I have to learn new things, But I think it was minimal. Nobody was actually practicing test-driven development by far. It was more like, okay, we got something working. Let's write a test about it to sort of like verify that this is working and then wrap it up. But to sort of like change your thought process around, because you are for a lot of developers, you're going 180 degrees around, right? I mean, yeah. So now we're going to think about the test first. Don't worry about the code. Don't worry about you have some idea of the design, of course, of what objects are in play here, but make the test. Can this be tested? And if it can't be tested, then there's something wrong with your design, right? So then you can dabble more in the design or try and think out other concepts. But I find it in the beginning, it was a bit of a struggle. Like, okay, shit, now we need to define it. How do we define the tests here? What is it that I really want? What do I want? So like, what answers do I want this object to give me, right? What should I ask it?
Yeah, yeah. So, in my experience, there's two big obstacles to going from little or no testing to a healthy testing scenario, which is if the team doesn't have much experience with testing, then that's a big obstacle. And then the design of the existing code can, of course, be a big obstacle too. Not just the design of the existing code, but like starting from a scenario where there's like no existing test infrastructure, or maybe there is a testing infrastructure, but it's poor quality or something like that. Even if everybody is already quite well-versed in testing, those technical hurdles can pose a big challenge also. And often you have both, and overcoming that is really difficult. So like, to what degree have you guys been able to, first of all, have you experienced those same obstacles? And if so, to what degree do you feel like you've been able to overcome those?
I'm not sure I can say we have overcome all the obstacles. I think we still have a lot of those obstacles in place, especially when you are working on existing code base. And I think that the obstacle is there that if you are working on a code base that has a low test coverage, you kind of tend to follow the pattern, even though someone is telling you like, don't follow the pattern, you tend to like just follow the pattern that's already in place there in the code base. So I think it is a large obstacle, and I can't honestly say that we have completely overcome it.
I would have been shocked if you told me you did completely overcome it, because that would be quite the achievement. But anyway, continue.
That would have been a totally different podcast for sure. But if anyone has overcome that, then yeah, I would also like to hear about that. But I can honestly say that with anything new that is being developed, like in at least on the microservices framework, is tested. And there, from what I gather from the teams, is that yes, they follow test-driven development and they enjoy it. It's a good, once you get used to it, make it a habit. It's like you don't want to be without it, and you don't want to develop it without it. And I think we do have one product whose teams are definitely, even though it's an old product with a lot of old code, I think they have managed to overcome not all the obstacles, but quite a bit of them, and they are running more test driven than anyone else that I've seen though. Okay. So that's but we still have work to do for sure.
Okay. It's going to be time to wrap up soon, but I'm curious, even though you're doing sounds like C# stuff now, and maybe you yourself aren't really doing that much programming hands-on these days, is that right?
Yeah, I'm not day-to-day work during the workday, at least, no.
Okay. How about outside of work? What kind of stuff do you do as a hobby or whatever?
Outside of work, I try to right now. Yes, I want to get more familiar with C sharp, and of course, I still don't want to leave behind Rails. I enjoy working in Rails, and it's a beautiful framework, absolutely, and to work with, and of course, working on the upcoming Rails 8, the Rails 8 way. Work, it also helps me to do some programming, and I have not tried any of the AI stuff yet, but it's on my list of things to do next. So fortunately, I had to purchase Obi's new book
Yeah, I
on
was
that
gonna say
topic.
Obi can definitely steer you in some directions with the AI stuff.
Yeah. So that's the next things that I want to dabble away with. But I had a few minor projects that I started, but unfortunately have not put too much effort into it. But I'm not going to put the what you say, the coding. I don't know if you have this expression in English. In Norwegian, we say that the coding gloves. It's sort of like you put on some gloves and you code. Like I'm not gonna take my coding gloves up and put them on the shelf just yet. But
Oh yeah. Yeah,
yeah.
I'm trying to think if we have an equivalent. Like sometimes we say like I'm gonna put on my coding hat now and do my coding.
Right.
So maybe for things that you would wear gloves for in Norway, you wear a hat for in America.
It could be. It could be.
Yeah, and part of why I ask about that is like if you're still having a foot in the Rails ecosystem and stuff, are you planning to go to any of the upcoming Ruby conferences?
I haven't planned, but I would very much like to. But unfortunately, with the job that I'm in at the moment requires quite a bit of traveling, and so when I'm not working, it's not too popular.
Yeah.
But if there is, so yes, the answer is if I can get some time off to travel to any of the Ruby conferences, yes. And I would love to have gone to the Rails World Conference, for instance.
Oh, yeah.
But I'm not going to make any promises, but who knows?
Yeah, maybe Yuriko will make it to Norway one of these years.
Yeah,
You know about
that would.
Yuriko?
I've heard about it, but this was they it's like a European Rails conference that moves around Europe from year to year. Is
Yeah,
that?
exactly.
Yeah. Yeah,
Yeah.
well, if it comes to Norway, I definitely go. Then I have to go.
Yeah,
There's no
then you have to
excuse.
go. Yeah. All right. Well, Tom, it's been really good talking with you. Anything you want to share with listeners before we go? Any place they should go to check you out online? Anything like that?
I'm not a very active person online. I have an X account or Twitter account, LinkedIn, of course. If you want to reach out, just send a message on LinkedIn. I'm happy to talk, have a virtual coffee.
Yeah, and obviously people should keep their eye out for the Rails 8 way, which is going to have your fingerprints on it. Is there any way people can like sign up to get notified about news of that or anything like that?
That's a good question. No, not at the moment, but we should get a landing page out for that. But not unfortunately, you'll have to just wait. It will be published on LeanPub.
Okay, it'll be published on LeanPub. That's good to know.
And, I know that LeanPub is very good at advertising on X, at least.
Yeah, and you know what might actually be great? We can talk about this later, but having you and Obi and the other gentleman,
Lucas,
we can do an episode with all of us closer to when the book comes out.
Oh yeah, that would be great.
Yeah. All right. Well, great. Tom, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Well, thank you for having me.